Hello, I'm Gil Bailey, president of the Cornerstone Forum. Last month I was asked to make a few remarks at a luncheon in California, honoring San Francisco Archbishop George Niederauer and Professor Emeritus René Girard of Stanford University. Following the luncheon, some of those in attendance asked for a copy of my remarks, and a few friends suggested that they be expanded and made more widely available. This led to the idea of repeating what I did with a talk I gave this summer in London, that is, to share the text of my remarks with the Cornerstone Forum's friends and supporters, meanwhile making an audio recording of the remarks and tossing it like a message in a bottle on the choppy seas of the Internet, there to bob around on those shifting currents until eventually it washes up on the shores of those who might find it useful. Admittedly, this strategy is heavily dependent on the spirit who famously blows where he will. But this dependence has always been at the heart of the Cornerstone Forum's efforts. One of the things that these remarks owe to the luncheon at which their seeds were sown is my use of a Catholic vocabulary. Since my luncheon comments were intended to encourage the Archbishop and others present to recognize how important Girard's work is destined to be for the Church as it confronts the challenges of our time, I resorted to a Catholic vocabulary even more uninhibitedly than usual. I trust my non-Catholic friends will be able to transpose this vocabulary as needed into roughly corresponding terms more familiar to them. What follows, when all is said and done, is a set of loosely connected reflections on issues too complex to be treated here with the thoroughness each deserves. To me, at least, there is a thread running through them, but it is a thin one that may be all but invisible to others. In any case, in penance for failing to clean things up any better than I have, I hope in due course to supplement this offering with occasional reflections exploring in more detail how Girard's work helps illuminate today's cultural and spiritual predicament and how valuable his work is for the Church. In the meantime, here are some thoughts which I hope you will find of some merit. Quote, "Christ's resurrection created a new world," wrote Henri de Lubac in the first half of the 20th century. Quote, "It marks the beginning of a fresh new age and has set up on earth a type of existence which is absolutely novel," end quote. Of this unequivocal profession of faith, it might be hard to convince even church-going Christians today. How rare is it today to hear the faith as exuberantly affirmed as de Lubac did more than half a century ago? And as, for instance, the Orthodox scholar David Bentley Hart has done more recently. Hart writes in his latest book, quote, "The rise of Christianity produced consequences so immense that it can almost be said to have begun the world anew, to have invented the human, to have bequeathed us our most basic concept of nature, to have determined our vision of the cosmos and our place in it, and to have shaped all of us, to one degree or another, in the deepest reaches of consciousness," end quote. Contrary to a tendency in recent years toward more circumspect avowals of Christian faith, Cardinal de Lubac and David Bentley Hart remind us that equivocation, however sincerely motivated or well-intentioned, will in the end both weaken the faith of those who express it and make the faith thus timidly professed less credible to the skeptical world. Not, of course, that the skeptical world is in any mood for such full-throated professions of faith. In fact, the Swiss theologian Hans-Urs von Balthasar has suggested that the central drama of history today is, quote, "an ever-intensifying no to the yes uttered by God in Christ," end quote, which involves, von Balthasar argues, the reciprocal intensification of the yes and the no to Christianity and the moral revolution it has awakened. However puzzling that assessment might have seemed when von Balthasar issued it a few decades ago, intervening developments, both in our own culture and beyond, have largely confirmed his analysis. Of course, the world, in quotation marks, can be expected to persist in its efforts to expel the truth it tried to expel on Golgotha. That is, you might say, what the world gets paid to do. Even as they try to encounter this worldly no, however, Christians should acknowledge that without it, their own faith might well grow complacent and perhaps vanish. On the other hand, if they do not respond with a yes of at least comparable vigor, the consequences for those who come after them will be grave. And so it is now incumbent on Christians to express a yes that is more loving, more truthful, more profound than the world's no. even when that yes has to take the form of a no to the forces that are busily trying to expel the Christian influence, at the heart of such a no, there should be a detectable yes to the truth, goodness, and beauty for which Christians should be a beacon, a yes undeterred by the moral relativism and ideological pastimes of our day. That, quote, world of which I have just spoken is not the world of a century ago or even a quarter of a century ago. We live now in a highly globalized and electronically interconnected world, consisting of countless peoples and cultures, many of whom are predisposed to see Christian truth claims as preposterous or offensive. Embarrassed by this new situation, many of us have chosen the line of least resistance, embracing a sentimental multiculturalism, which is not only a very poor substitute for, but in fact a parody of, Christian Catholicity. Christian history has repeatedly shown, however, that it is precisely in confronting new challenges in the context of new historical situations that Christians stumble upon theretofore unexplicated features of the faith that is ever ancient, ever new, and the historical and cultural predicament Christians face today has all the earmarks of just such a moment of theological deepening. Hans-Urs von Balthasar brought the first volume of his theodrama to an abrupt and provocative conclusion by quoting a 1921 observation by the Austrian philosopher Ferdinand Ebner, quote, "Did Western civilization founder, and it has already foundered, on anything other than the stylizing of the cross, on its Platonic misunderstanding of Christianity? Let us not deceive ourselves. It is this and nothing else that has brought forth the unbelief and the godlessness of our time," end quote. The subtle appeal of a Platonized Christianity of the sort that Ebner lamented is that it tends to dehistoricize the faith, thereby freeing it from entangling particularities that seem to undermine its claim to universal significance. One can easily understand why such a temptation has persistently recommended itself to Christian apologists. The conventionally religious or philosophical mind instinctively prefers an ahistorical narrative, a cosmic Christ, for instance, or a disincarnate narrative that, as they say, never was and always is. For to the conventionally religious mind, Christianity's claim to anthropological universality and its historic ties to events in the eastern backwater of the Roman Empire at an otherwise rather uneventful moment in history seem to cancel each other out. In the end, however, to sacrifice or even downplay the historicity of Christianity's constituent events in the interest of protecting its claim to universality is to betray both. The task of accounting for what Henri de Lubac called Christianity's concrete universality is a daunting but indispensable one. The Cistercian abbot, Denis Farkasfalvi, has recognized this issue and expressed it boldly. "We must," he writes, quote, "give account in a credible way of a realistic concept of salvation history which tradition posits to be in some sense a reality encompassing all forms and stages of human existence," end quote. That is an almost breathtaking statement. If Christianity's universal claims are to be sustained, Father Farkasfalvi says, the salvation it purports to offer must be seen to encompass all forms and all stages of human existence. To do this, Father Farkasfalvi writes, quote, "one will have to confront more clearly the theological question of how Christ has been truly present for those generations that lived at the dawn of human history, and how mankind's religious history should be conceived as a period of advent in a general sense, in preparation for Christ, and how the Old Testament is related to this period as a divinely designed pathway for Christ's arrival," end quote. In other words, to be faithful to Christianity's ultimate claims, therefore, we Christians will have to give an account of how the Christ event relates to the entire human drama from beginning to end. In a similar vein, Hans-Urs von Balthasar, citing the work of Father Peter Onrici, S.J., who happens to have been von Balthasar's cousin and later a Swiss bishop, points out that our word physics comes from the Greek word for nature, and that for the Greek philosophers, the loftiest peak of the natural order was the cosmos itself. So the Greek philosophical quest for the transcendent meaning of existence itself came to be known as metaphysics. Biblical thought, on the other hand, is not only unapologetically anthropocentric, moreover it is, as first Onrici and then von Balthasar noted, fundamentally personal and relational. In biblical thought, and especially in Christian thought, the human person, not the physical cosmos, is creation's preeminent mystery, not least because by Christian reckoning, each person is made in the image and likeness of the persons of the triune God. Hence writes von Balthasar, the necessity of transposing metaphysics into meta-anthropology, without, von Balthasar hastens to add, neglecting the meaning of meta. I will return to this last point. Meanwhile, von Balthasar goes on to say, quote, traces of this transposition of the Greek consciousness into the personal Christian one are certainly present in Augustine, and according to the interpretation of J.B. Metz, in St. Thomas as well. Still, a mere continuation of higher late scholasticism will not be sufficient for this, though it may provide us with some valuable building stones, end quote. Forging the kind of meta-anthropology required by our present situation is something that Pope Benedict XVI appears to think is appropriate, as did his friend von Balthasar, for he has suggested that a collaboration between theology and anthropology can lead, quote, to the truly most exciting part of Christian faith, end quote. 2 years after Ferdinand Ebner complained that an eviscerated understanding of the crucifixion was at the root of, quote, the unbelief and godlessness of our time, on Christmas Day in Avignon, France, René Girard was born. Eventually, he would make an enormous contribution to the rectification of the situation to which Ebner had called attention. Not that Girard set out to do this. He set out to mind his own business as an historian and a reader of European literature. But these things led him on an intellectual journey in the course of which he mastered whole disciplines the way few managed to master single subsets within them. The result was an insight into our human makeup and our historical predicament that just coincidentally served to substantiate in the most fascinating way some of the principal truth claims of Christianity. By drawing on the rich theological tradition for which the present Pope is today's preeminent exponent, as well as on the extraordinary anthropological corroboration René Girard has provided for Christianity's claim to both uniqueness and universality, we can, I would like to suggest, discover, quote, the truly most exciting part of Christian faith, restore the confidence of the beleaguered faithful, and begin anew to meet the daunting challenges now facing the Church. In the 1960s, as the Fathers of the Second Vatican Council were calling for a renewed dialogue between the Church and the world, and implicitly between theology and anthropology, René Girard was beginning to formulate an anthropological assessment of the human predicament which could hardly have been more fitted to the task to which the Council was calling the Church. The collaboration between theology and anthropology, which René Girard's work greatly facilitates, really involves something like the return of the prodigal son. For anthropology is actually a child of Abraham, the long-lost cousin of Jeremiah and St. Paul. With the worldwide expansion of Western culture at the beginning of the modern era, anthropology as a distinct social science began to emerge. But alas, its awakening coincided with the European Enlightenment, under the influence of which anthropology, along with its sister social sciences, was seduced into believing that it could only be true to its calling by renouncing its biblical ancestry as intellectually nugatory. Though anthropologists were able to amass a treasure trove of incredibly fascinating data, estranged as they were from the biblical patrimony that could have inspired its synthesis, the new science could do little more than aggregate its findings. Christ had said, "Those who do not gather with me will be scattered," and it was only a matter of time before the anthropological data disaggregated into a welter of discrete factoids regarded as culturally specific, and the science itself succumbed to the lure of multicultural relativism. This was more or less the state of the discipline when Girard began to rummage through its storehouse in the late 1960s. His gradual synthesis of the ethnographic data culminated, to his own amazement, in his recognition of the unparalleled anthropological significance of the biblical tradition. To date, alas, the happy reunion between the prodigal discipline and its Judeo-Christian progenitor remains tentative. Some social scientists, still reluctant to grant epistemological value to the biblical tradition, and some Christian traditionalists playing the role of the disgruntled elder brother. Girard was and is a faithful and practicing Catholic, a man loyal to the magisterium, who expressed to me his delight upon hearing of the elevation of Joseph Ratzinger to the chair of Peter. But he is not a member of the theological guild, and suspicions lingered. Lately things have greatly improved. Perhaps Girard's election to the Académie Française has contributed to this. In any event, Catholic theologians and prelates have begun to recognize the value of his contribution and to seek out his counsel. As I've written elsewhere, the collaboration between Catholic theology and Girard's anthropological contribution to it will need to proceed with all due care. But having lived and worked at the intersection of these two currents for many years, I have no doubt that the fruits of their confluence will be immense, not least because a chorus of church voices has begun to speak of the need for an engagement between theology and anthropology. Hans von Balthasar, for instance, has written that, quote, an anthropology will have to be constructed in which all the dimensions discovered by the modern world can unfold and develop. What is needed, he goes on to say, is an anthropology which is both up-to-date and Christian, that is to say, illuminated by the light of revelation, end quote. Father Farkas Falvey has echoed that with a characteristically sweeping summation of the challenge in all its anthropological breadth and theological depth. Quote, obviously, he wrote, there awaits us the job of tying together our understanding of the Bible and humankind's universal religious history, both in its prehistoric age and in the history of human culture, end quote. It is my considered opinion that this is what René Girard has done. He has rendered a credible and intelligible account of humanity's universal history, both in the prehistoric age and in the history of human culture, and he has done so precisely by recognizing, on the basis of the most impressive anthropological erudition, the unique history-altering centrality of the passion and death of Christ. This is not a place to try to summarize Girard's opus. I propose rather to suggest, with a few brief brushstrokes, what an extraordinary contribution he has made to Christian self-understanding. Suffice it to say that Girard has shown that human culture not only spontaneously originates in a scene that is structurally identical to the one on Golgotha, but that culture thus constituted thereafter preserves some semblance of the social solidarity born of the founding violence by ritually reenacting these immolations, and in times of crisis spontaneously repeating them, venting their sundry social animosities on one hapless victim, in whose death or expulsion the community joins and rejoices, restoring thereby social order and harmony. Members of the Pulitzer Committee, please note the award-winning parsimoniousness of the foregoing one-sentence, 83-word summary. Quote, it is better that one should die than that the whole nation should be destroyed, end quote, said Caiaphas, in the New Testament's supremely parsimonious 13-word summary of the cultural efficacy of the all-against-one system of social rejuvenation. The fact that this primordial and perennial scene is structurally identical with the scene on Golgotha is key to Christianity's anthropological universality. But the key to its utter uniqueness is that, in contrast to the conventional mythological recollections of this scene, which always interpret it in ways flattering to the self-righteous community, the gospel alone sees what fallen humanity had theretofore managed to conceal from itself, the innocence of the victim and the madness of the crowd. Expressed in such unsubtle and unexplicated ways, this quick summary almost surely raises more questions than it answers, but it is these questions which we hope to explore in more detail in later reflections. Having given anthropological weight to Christianity's 2,000-year-old insistence on the historically unparalleled meaning of the crucifixion, it might seem ungracious and impertinent to ask Girardian thought for further aid. But it turns out that Girard has provided an especially penetrating analysis of the spiritual and psychological crisis that is entangled with the larger cultural one. So widespread is this crisis, especially among the young, that it more or less passes for normality. Not only can Girard's analysis of what he calls mimetic desire throw enormous light on this veritable pandemic, but it can enrich our understanding of the perennial mystery of the human person and the contemporary crisis of the human subject as powerfully as it has revolutionized our understanding of human culture. For if his compelling anthropological findings challenge our presuppositions about history and culture, his insight into the nature of human subjectivity makes it clear how inherently unstable the modern self really is. And on closer analysis, what was lost as the putatively autonomous individual came to replace the richer and theologically underwritten notion of the person. If, as Girard has shown, conventional culture itself has a paschal structure, albeit one that the paschal drama dramatically inverts, he has also shown that the human subject is structured for discipleship, inasmuch as the irreducible fact of human subjectivity is what Girard calls mimetic desire. Our desires, which is to say our aspirations, are acquired from models whom we emulate either consciously or more often unconsciously. To borrow a Ronerian formulation, not only are all human religions, quote, Christologies in search of a subject, but so, after a fashion, is each one of us. It is due to the human subject's unavoidable dependence on models and on what is typically an unconscious, disciple-like mimetic imitation of models that Tertullian's observation that the soul is naturally Christian can be anthropologically affirmed. The New Testament is replete not only with passages explicitly recognizing the unavoidably mimetic nature of human subjectivity, but with emphatic endorsements of imitation. Follow me. I have left you an example. Imitate me as I imitate Christ. I only do what I see the Father doing. These and countless other passages make it clear that Christian anthropology addresses the mimetic fact of our existence. But with the secularization of the modern era and the emergence of the Enlightenment ideal of radical individuality, however, a massive anthropological shell game began, the purpose of which was to flatter the modern subject with the conceit of psychological autonomy. The result was that the imitatio Christi, the veneration of saints, and the various ways in which pre-modern Christianity intuitively recognized the operation of mimetic desire and provided apt models for it was now looked on as passé. It became fashionable to regard imitation as something that both could and should be forsworn as incompatible with the individual's dignity and authenticity. The result, as Girard has said, is that the imitation of Christ has been replaced by the imitation of one's neighbor, or of some figure randomly thrown up for emulation by popular culture, and the consequences of this transfer of mimetic attention from a worthy and socially transcendent model to a haphazardly selected and socially proximate one with whom one is likely to become rivalistic is both spiritually impoverishing and socially problematic. It is what Girard calls the mimetic crisis in the midst of which we are now living, a crisis at the heart of which, Girard argues, is an ontological sickness, what Henri de Lubac described as, quote, the waning of ontological density, end quote. Anthropological miscalculations end in misery, whether they occur at the cultural level, as with communism, fascism, or relativism, or at the subjective level, as in the case of the autonomous self-constituted self. Girard has seen this anthropological miscalculation through the lens of his mimetic theory, and he has seen it, I think, vividly and correctly. A couple of decades earlier, however, Romano Guardini saw the looming crisis of subjectivity from a theological perspective, which is, in my opinion, perfectly compatible with Girard's analysis. Quote, "The knowledge of what it means to be a person," writes Guardini, "is inextricably bound up with the faith of Christianity. An affirmation and a cultivation of the personal can endure for a time, perhaps, after faith has been extinguished, but gradually they too will be lost," end quote. The philosopher Michael Polanyi, to whom I will turn again in a moment, independently concurs with Guardini, noting that there is a surprising affinity between the conception of personhood and a central doctrine of Christianity. As intellectually compelling and creedally reassuring as Girard's anthropological corroboration of Christian doctrine is, however, the Paschal drama and the magnitude and scope of the Christian claim regarding its meaning will always appear scandalous to some and folly to others. For as the conciliar document Gaudium et Spes reminds us, what it reveals is not only the sobering truth about sinful humanity, but the breathtaking truth about the triune God, the God, moreover, in whose image and likeness the human person is made. The result is a revelatory event of enormous complexity. As von Balthasar put it in the 1930s, quote, "It does not seem self-evident that an, quote, accidental historical event like the crucifixion of a man in the corner of the Roman Empire antecedently conditions and determines not only the entire course of world history, but more profoundly, the inner reality of every human being, in fact, the entire ontological structure of every person," end quote. It is not just the sweeping claims that Christianity makes about the historical and cultural ramifications of the crucifixion that cause scandal and skepticism, for those claims encounter a resistance too embedded in our fallen humanity to be dislodged by an act of intellectual assent alone. As Girard himself has pointed out in Things Hidden Since the Foundation of the World, quote, "In reality, no purely intellectual process and no experience of a purely philosophical nature can secure the individual the slightest victory over mimetic desire and its victimage delusions. For there to be even the slightest degree of progress, the victimage delusion must be vanquished on the most intimate level of experience," end quote. There is another convergence here with the thought of the philosopher Michael Polanyi, who in his reflections on the interplay of faith and reason observes that, quote, "Religious conversion commits our whole person and changes our whole being in a way that an expansion of natural knowledge does not do," end quote. Far from shunning a rational adjudication of its truth claims, of course, Catholic Christianity has always insisted on the indispensable role of reason in accounting for Christian faith. But the rational defense of faith cannot be so successful that the act of faith itself ceases to be necessary. Christian faith requires an act of untrammeled freedom. It is proposed but never imposed. It awaits a yes that is in no way coerced from it by any kind of logical undeniability. Whatever intellectual misgivings a convincing philosophical account of Christian faith might be able to overcome, therefore, deep-seated resistances to Christian truth survive these efforts. Quote, "If today you hear his voice, harden not your hearts," end quote, admonishes the psalmist and the author of Hebrews. It is precisely when one hears his voice that, in T.S. Eliot's words, quote, "the weak spirit quickens to rebel." We are persons in the full Christian sense of that word precisely because we are each called by name from the moment of conception. That call can be initially answered by the mere act of clinging to life. But as we grow in our capacity to respond more consciously and graciously to that call, there comes a moment when we begin to realize that the voice we are hearing is the voice of the crucified one saying, quote, "take up your cross and follow me," that we are being called to a life of self-renunciation. It is at that moment that the call meets resistance at the deepest level, an involuntary Mephistophelian assertion of autonomy, for which we only subsequently manage to supply some intellectual or moral rationale. Whatever the value of intellectual assent, the Church is necessarily concerned with the process of conversion that occurs, in Girard's words, on the most intimate level of experience, and that depends less on evidence and argumentation than on one's willingness to allow the encountered truth to reorder one's life accordingly, a willingness which it is the task of liturgy, sacraments, and communal worship to foster and regularly revive. Neither the Academy nor any other non-ecclesial institution has the resources to elicit the requisite level of assent. And regrettably, many ecclesial bodies have purchased a place at the cultural high table by neglecting or marginalizing these resources. However valuable doctrinal propositions are in protecting Christian truth from succumbing to the spirit of the age, Christian truth is not propositional. It is participatory. Lex orandi, lex credendi. The spirit that leads to the whole truth is more a choreographer than a catechist, and not even a Platonized Christianity could cripple the transmission of Christian faith from one generation to the next as effectively as the gradual attenuation of the sacramental sensibilities requisite to a lived experience of Christian truth. Sensibilities which it has been the historical privilege and responsibility of Catholic Christianity to foster, and which it has been the collateral effect of modernity to extinguish. Locke sank into a swoon, Yeats wrote. The garden died. God took the spinning jenny out of his side. End quote. What Yeats' mordant commentary on the shriveled modern imagination brings to mind is the Johannine image, conflated by many of the church fathers with the Genesis story Yeats parodied, of Christ falling into a mortal sleep on Golgotha, so that out of the pierced side of the bridegroom, the ecclesial bride might be brought forth in the form of the blood and water of the church's sacramental life. The fact that this scriptural and patristic trope seems so jarring even to the Catholic sensibility in the late modern period is a measure of the loss of the imaginative resources for entering into the heart of the church's ecclesial and Eucharistic mystery. To accuse this patristic audacity of mythologization is to miss the fundamentally historical character of the detail upon which the Johannine and patristic authors have seized. This is not, as in myth, a misty allusion to a primordial event or perennially recurring process. It is the account of an historical event, something that actually happened one afternoon in the first part of the first century AD at a particular moment, rendered without damage to its historicity in an imaginative idiom more capable than a strictly documentary account of bringing its deeper meaning to the fore. The Christian mystery is incomprehensible, but it is not unintelligible. Its intelligibility, however, is inaccessible to minds and hearts open only to knowledge that leaves the moral and ontological status quo undisturbed. For the mystery exists precisely to rescue us from the dreary, death-enshrouded status quo. What I'm calling the Catholic sacramental sensibility has an affinity with what Michael Polanyi called live knowledge. That is, knowledge which, because it never lets familiarity with the known breed contempt, remains attentive to the commonplace, fully expecting new surprises. Live knowledge, writes Polanyi, is, quote, a perpetual source of new surmises and an inexhaustible mine of still hidden implications, end quote. It is this, in my view, that enabled the Johannine and patristic authors to eventually recognize a very large truth in a very small factual detail. This fruitful and fructifying imagination is made possible by faith, and it is, as Catholic tradition has for centuries affirmed, not only perfectly compatible with reason, but indispensable to its greatest achievements. Faith leads to understanding, which is something far richer than mere knowledge. To know from empirical observation that blood and water oozed from the lanced side of Christ's corpse is a far cry from sensing how that seemingly incidental anatomical fact contained within itself a larger implication. To speak of such things in the ecclesial vocabulary, which was more or less cobbled together for that purpose, We might say that though in all likelihood the meaning of this incidental detail eluded its original observer, by the late first century when John's Gospel was being written, the Spirit of truth had made it possible for the evangelist to recognize how isomorphic with his community's baptismal and Eucharistic life the incidental detail recalled from the crucifixion actually was. And by the time the Church Fathers were reflecting on John's Gospel, the conjunction between the two had attained its full ecclesial significance. It goes without saying that by contemporary standards, the audacity the Johannine and patristic authors exhibited is dismissed as epistemologically risible. But these cramped standards are precisely the ones that have had the effect of extinguishing the sacramental imagination and thereby cutting us off from the living water of our religious heritage and leaving us thirsting at empty cisterns. Happily, not everyone has remained on the intellectual reservation. Again, the philosopher Michael Polanyi found himself moving toward what I'm calling a sacramental sensibility. There is, he argues, no other way of approaching a hidden meaning than by entrusting ourselves to our intimations of its yet unseen presence, end quote. And so, as indispensable as Girard's work has been in accounting for the historical and cultural decisiveness of the crucifixion, participation in the Christian truth that Girard's insights make more intelligible will require the recovery of the sacramental sensibilities which are, I feel, cognate with the uniquely Christian understanding of personhood of which Guardini, Polanyi, Joseph Ratzinger, and many others have written. Without the reinvigoration of these more supple sensibilities and a startlingly fresh reappraisal of the uniquely Christian provenance of the form of subjectivity we call the person, we are not likely to raise up saints in sufficient number to breathe new life into the Church and the world it exists to transform. And things like, I am in the Father and the Father is in me, and Paul's, I live now, no longer I, but Christ lives in me, will remain iconic but fundamentally incomprehensible. Seen in the light of the inherently interdividual or perichoretic structure of human identity that Girard's mimetic theory postulates, however, these and other New Testament conundrums can be rescued from their Delphic impenetrability and held up as the defining feature of the new life in Christ that the Gospel announces. In calling for the transition from a metaphysics to a meta-anthropology, von Balthasar cautioned that care must be taken not to neglect its meta-dimension. This is where I think what I have called the sacramental sensibility can enrich our understanding of the anthropological data for which René Girard has given such an incomparable accounting, and enable us to see in the myriad details of Girard's analysis, something like what the patristic writers were able to see in the Johannine allusion to the lanced side of Christ. For Christianity brings to the quest for truth an analytic that it cannot surrender and still make its distinctive contribution to human self-understanding. What it brings is precisely the Logos, the Word in the flesh, the truth as a person, a diagnostic for which it can claim no credit, but of which it must not be embarrassed. The Logos, to which Christians have been made privy through no merit of their own, is the Word through whom all things were made and without whom nothing that came to be came to be. Challenging, though that is for Christian apologetics, what Orthodox Christians affirm is that the created order itself has the same form, the same gestalt, the same pattern as the Word made flesh, which Paul insists is fully revealed only on the cross. At the cosmic level, it is what von Balthasar has called the watermark of the cross on creation. At the human level, it is the paschal form which Girard has discovered at the heart of human culture itself. At the level of the individual subject, it is the predisposition to imitate the God in whose image and likeness the subject is made and whose living icon Jesus was. Christianity, in other words, works because it is the truth about humanity. As the oft-quoted paragraph 22 of Gaudium et Spes insists, the truth is that only in the mystery of the incarnate Word does the mystery of man take on light. End quote. It is Christ, write the authors of this conciliar document, who, quote, fully reveals man to himself and makes his supreme calling clear, end quote. What von Balthasar wrote of the theological value of Adrian von Speer, whose mystical experiences and writings were, of course, considerably more controversial than anything René Girard has written, could, mutatis mutandis, be said with even more confidence, I feel, of René Girard. Quoting von Balthasar, "The Holy Spirit may suddenly illuminate parts of revelation that have always been there, but have not been sufficiently reflected upon. The history of the Church confirms this. Before St. Francis, no one had thought so deeply about the poverty of Christ. Before Augustine, many had spoken of the love of God, but none did it in as penetrating a manner as he. Correspondingly," von Balthasar adds, "aspects exist in Adrian von Speer's work that have not been as expressly discovered in Revelation before her. But once examined carefully, one realizes that they work." As I say, one can substitute René Girard for Adrian von Speer in that passage without altering its conclusion. Once carefully examined, one realizes that it works. With Girard, we are able to see in far more anthropological detail the unparalleled impact of the gospel on history and culture. From its prehistoric antecedents in the origin of culture itself, through its spiritual and moral prelude in the history of the Jewish people, to its outworking consequences in the aftermath of the gospel revelation, right into our own day. "There exist elements in the natural sphere," writes von Balthasar, it was Guardini who taught me to realize this, "which reveal their significance only when touched by supernatural light," end quote. Although Girard's original research occurred independently of any creedal presuppositions on his part, he has acknowledged that had it not been for the presence of these creedal factors in his intellectual milieu as well as in his personal experience, the anthropological data he accumulated and strove to make intelligible might not have coalesced as powerfully and cogently as they did. The accusation of some of Girard's secular critics that Christian doctrine was driving his intellectual project from the beginning is certainly false. But had there been no such doctrine providing a subtle gravitational influence, his thought might well have taken a more equivocal form and become a sociological or anthropological footnote. The same will, I suspect, be true of the intellectual legacy he has left us. As hermeneutically convincing and intellectually satisfying as Girard's contribution is, if it is to have its effect at, quote, the most intimate level of experience, it will need to be subsumed into the Church's life. As this happened, the symbolic realism, which allowed the Johannine and patristic authors to see a much greater reality in the small historical observation made at the foot of the cross, can perhaps serve as an analog for how the Church can assimilate Girard's anthropological discoveries and make them spiritually fruitful. And so if Girard's anthropological insights provide Christian thought generally and Catholic theology especially with resources for better accounting for some of the sweeping claims Christianity makes, it is also the case that Catholic thought makes a distinctive contribution to Girard's legacy. For not only were his insights to a degree made possible by the presence in both his cultural milieu and personal experience of a Christianity centered on the Passion story, but his anthropological contributions are most likely to have their full potential, that is, to affect lives more profoundly than merely at the intellectual or even the moral level, if they are taken up into the Church's greater and grander task of conversion, where they can be gradually assimilated into the homiletic, liturgical, and Eucharistic life of the Church. It is, I think, those whose sacramental sensibilities have been preserved or reawakened who will be able to make the best use of the tools Girard has made available to us. For what the Johannine and patristic authors were able to recognize in the anatomical detail recorded by an observer on Golgotha, those with comparable sacramental sensibilities will be able to see in the myriad details of Girardian analysis. Having recovered from what William Blake called single vision and Newton's sleep, they will be able to see in the anthropological data the Christological and Trinitarian meta-anthropology to which it is ordered. And finally, on a personal note, none of us today will live long enough to see René Girard's work bear all the fruit it is destined to bear. Those of us fortunate enough to have him as a friend and teacher, however, have the privilege of being able to thank him in advance and in person for the intellectual legacy he has left us and for the example of a well-lived life that stands as the ultimate warrantor of his legacy. Nor can anyone who knows René doubt for a moment that what he has done has been possible because throughout these many years he has had at his side his extraordinarily generous and gracious wife, Martha, to whom we also owe a very large debt of gratitude. I'm Gil Bailey for the Cornerstone Forum.
For more presentations by Gil Bailey and information about the Cornerstone Forum, please visit the Cornerstone Forum's website at www.cornerstone-forum.org. Thank you.